Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by a guest that we don't normally have the CEO, CEOs on the podcast. And this one, we decided to sort of make an exception because the way he described his role was essentially how he supports the sales team. So I'd like to welcome Brandon Bruce, founder and CEO at Cirrus Insight. Now, first question, why not Cumulonimbus Insight? I think that would have just had such a better, you know, more.
That's true. It rolls off the tongue better and there's no confusion. Last year, there was some confusion among some folks that we call this Citrus Insight. So I thought we'd go into the orange juice analytics futures sort of analysis type company, or one introduced us as Circus Insight. So we could track, Barnum and Bailey around the country and see how their performances are trending. But now we're Cirrus, the high wispy clouds. And I thought you let me on the show as a height exception, right? I'd be your tallest guest, at least so far this year, since I'm about 6'8". But regardless of the reason, thanks for having me back on the show. It's great to be with you guys.
See, I think you're actually just 5'4", and you just always put your laptop way, way down. So we're always staring directly up at you.
That would be good. No, it's one of those funny things. If I go to conferences, say hello to somebody, and maybe we've known each other for a few weeks or a few years, but never met in person. And they'll be like, wow, no idea you were so tall. I was like, yeah, it doesn't really come through on email or Slack or the phone. That's all part of the fun of getting to meet people in person, or in this case, through Zoom.
Yeah. And anybody watching the video, they can see basically my face getting destroyed. I'm in a new location podcast-wise, and I didn't factor in the skylight.
Now does look sort of like a phone filter. You're in the bright light now.
This is terrifying. Maybe I should just hide my video here. Well, hopefully that adjusts itself. If you're watching on the YouTube, I apologize. We'll get it figured out for the next time. We've got some more lighting, some more a proper background. You know what I actually might do? I might just pause us here and sure. I'm going to just relocate. It'll take me 1 minute. Yeah. And we're back. Thanks for the little detour. Those watching notice I'm in a different spot, different brick. Still have the same sunlight, and hopefully the sun isn't chasing me, but we'll get it sorted for next time.
We added some nice artwork.
We did.
Things have only gotten better.
Mm-hmm. This is a Ken Foster. He actually lives in the area, and he probably painted that in a couple hours. Phenomenal artist, yeah. And all his stuff is basically, he always, this is, I don't know if you can really see it, but it looks like he pulled it off the back of a couch and just paints on the most random stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, we got a lot of his stuff that's printed on construction signs that were, let's just say, liberated or found.
Okay. Sure, yeah. They were dismissed.
So as the CEO, talk to me about your relationship with the sales team, because I imagine initially it was just you. Now you have a team that you support. Talk to me about that relationship. What's that like?
Yeah, so the company started, me and my co-founder, Ryan. Ryan is the CEO and runs the product team. I'm the COO and run the sales marketing support team, which early on just meant I was that whole team, right? So any sales call, any support call, any marketing effort that we did, that was me. And then as we were able to scale the team, I continued to do lots of sales and increasingly kind of focused on the highest needs customers, so the most complicated ones and typically the biggest ones. And then as we continued to grow, then the sales team really came into its own. Now we have a director of sales that really runs the show over there. So the big question is, okay, does the co-founder still sell, or am I still involved in selling? Yes and yes. I think that leadership should probably always be involved in sales at every aspect. So I think part of my role is sharing the good news about Cirrus Insight with as broad as audience as possible, right? Hence podcasts, blog posts, being active on social, telling people the story, and hopefully they engage. And so there's a prospecting element. reaching out to happy customers and finding out if they do business with other potential future customers as part of it. And then I think once there is engagement, then my role is a supporting one. So I'm not going to lead the product demo or the negotiation or the security review or the legal review, but I'm going to be there and support the sales team and the customer success team and the engineering team, whoever's involved in the whole process, to make sure the customer feels taken care of. So at a high level, you know, there's a few things that where hopefully I can add value just by doing some really kind of simple things. And one we talked about right before we came on air, and one of them is simply showing up. You know, at the beginning of the company, it was fun because everyone that called in and wanted to see the product or understand how does Serious Insight connect Gmail with Salesforce anyway? What does this look like? I'd love to show you. I'm one of the founders. You're getting in on the ground floor. You know, if you'd like to see another feature, I can get it in for you. So that was fun. But even today, that plays well. So anyone else on the sales team might be leading a deal. I can pop into the room, say hello on the Zoom call or on the audio bridge and just say, hey, I want to introduce myself. I'm Brandon. I'm a co-founder. Really excited to have the opportunity to work with you all. The whole team here is behind it. And you know, feel free to reach out. We're a very flat and open and reachable organization. So contact us anytime. And I think that just sends a good message that they're important to us, that we're attentive to detail, that we care about them as hopefully a future customer. And, you know, reflexively, I've always appreciated that. If I'm the customer on a demo of somebody else's product, if it's software or a service or anything else, it's like being in a restaurant, right? And the chef or the owner comes over and says, hey, how was the food today? And it's like, oh, so you really care about my opinion. You want to know for sure. And, yeah, that makes you want to go back because you feel like you're building a relationship.
Totally. I always joke with, I shouldn't say I always joke, but I feel like with our sales team, because I'm in a similar boat, and apologies for, I got the title mixed up. I think I said CEO when I introduced you there.
Oh, that's fine. That just gives me some ammunition to tease Ryan.
There you go. Sorry, Ryan, if you're listening. Yeah, I joke with our team that, you know, you're going to have to get a restraining order to keep me out of the sales process. You know, that's where I started. And I think it just adds so much value to be able to jump in and add a clients that, you know, like we do.
Someone shared a good adage the other day. They were actually talking about engineering because they came from an engineering background. Now they have a team, but I liked its application to sales, and they phrased it. This is probably something other people have heard, but it was the first time I heard it. So I'll repeat it now, was nose in, hands out. And I think that's a pretty good one. It's like, as a founder, it's like I stick my nose in the deal, see how it's going, inspect the deal, understand it, see where I can add value, but it, keep my hands out of it. So I'm not like, oh, so you want to see that feature? Well, let me go ahead and take over the screen share and I'll present it to you. And then the salesperson's like, why am I in the room? Like, I'm the one that set this whole thing up. So you don't want to hijack it, right? Get your hands all inside and mess up the deal. But poking in and saying I'm interested and I'm available and hopefully can be helpful, I think is something that helps the sales team advance to the next stage.
So I 100% agree. Aside from nose in, hands out, which I like that. Talk to me about some of the ways that you support the sales team.
So one of the big ones, and one that's coming up increasingly, it's always been a big deal, is security. The reason it's increasing is because of GDPR. So, you know, going back to the beginning when we started the company, you know, we're helping companies process sensitive data, data that goes to and from Salesforce. So it's data about their customers and their employees and their users, as well as from their inbox and from their calendar. So that's something that, you know, from day zero, we've always taken extremely seriously. So we do our own security protocols. We have third parties, you know, penetration test our systems to make sure they're really robust and secure and stable. But then we also pay attention to the legal frameworks that are available. So that meant being one of the very earliest companies to opt in to the US EU Privacy Shield, which was one of the precursors of what now is live, called GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation. So that's important, and probably preaching the choir of your listeners here, but it's important not just if you happen to have customers in Europe, because surely even if you just have domestic customers or local customers, they have users or customers or people that are using their systems that happen to be in Europe, are from Europe, are citizens in Europe, et cetera. And plus, the overall framework is kind of the direction that things are going anyway on the internet. And so it's good to get ready, good to get compliant, and good to communicate that out. So I think in my role, what I've tried to do, and some of this comes from background, having gone to law school, is try to get our ducks in a row from a documentation and audit perspective well in advance of the go live date for GDPR. So for the past several months, we've shared with any customer that requests it and signed what are called DPAs, so data protection addendums, usually an addendum onto the master services agreement. And that way they can review it, get up to speed on what data we're processing, what data, if any, that we're collecting on their behalf, and then sign off on kind of the privacy and security protocols that are mandated by GDPR. So we've gotten, as probably any software company that's listening out there has gotten, a lot of requests for that information. I think in my role, hopefully I've helped to preempt a lot of the requests by just volunteering it out to our customer base and letting them know that we're ready, but also being quick to respond to those. So going kind of to the adage of time kills all deals, and you don't want to frustrate your own customers. If they request it, we turn it around. I mean, it's instant, right? We've got it ready to go, pre-signed, all the data elements filled out so they can see it, review it on their end, sign it back. Or if they send us one, you know, we'll turn it around in a matter of hours so that they feel really comfortable and secure with the vendors that they've chosen. So compliance from a, we'll call it security, but now you're starting to see a lot of teams emerge that are risk mitigation, risk management. So there's a lot more requests, not only for GDPR compliance, but what's your end user license agreement look like? What are your terms of service? What's your privacy policy? What are your insurance policies? What's your whole disaster recovery plan? Folks are really paying attention to this whole panoply of things instead of just saying, do you have a privacy policy posted on your website? I mean, 10 years ago, that was like, that's great. You got a policy. We'll check that box. Now you got like 10 things lined up and ready to go. And so for those customers, especially as you get to the mid-market enterprise, that's a requirement for every deal. There's no way you're going to get to close without it. And so having that ready, I think is part of my role.
Gotcha. So in this case, you're sort of trying to understand what the customers are going to be asking for ahead of time, making sure that you've got all these docs pre-signed, pre-loaded, you know, whatever it is that they're going to need, because if you're 100% right, time does kill all deals. And maybe not all deals, but as a salesperson, there's nothing worse than losing that momentum when you get to the later stage of the deal, especially when you're trying to forecast.
It's a potential speed bump or a speed trap, right? I mean, you get pulled over and just kind of sit there for the next hour, which in deal terms could be a week or a month. And so one of the talks I heard, I think it was actually yesterday, the speaker was saying, you know, really focus on everything that you can do as a principal in your organization to make your employees' jobs easier, right? Take away all the friction. So it's like, if we're asking our salespeople, and sales is hard, let's start with that as a premise, to go out there and talk with customers, advance deals, do demos, customize use cases, personalized communications, et cetera. And the last thing you really want to do is handicap them by saying, oh, you got a GDPR request, that's weird. Tell me more about that. Is that a European thing? I guess we should look into that. I guess we'll have to write from scratch a 25-page document with 3 signature pages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That might take us a few weeks. And salesperson's like, what? We were just about to cross the line. So yeah, anticipating that need, preparing for it, and then being really quick to respond is good for the prospect, good for the customer. They feel well taken care of. But it's also a good way for us to focus on our own employees and just say, yeah, we've totally got your back when it comes to compliance. So you can focus on the relationship and the selling. We've got you covered on the risk mitigation security standpoint.
Gotcha. So what else do you do in terms of with the security? Is there anything else you do in terms of security review or compliance on that side?
Yeah, for me, a lot of it is kind of being the bridge between the sales success support team and the engineering team. So part of my role and the role of our director of operations is to intercept the security review requests. These are those spreadsheets or documents that sometimes have 50, they sometimes have 200 questions. Tell us everything about your company and about your technology, like from soup to nuts. And so rather than, oh, there's a bunch of tech questions, let me forward that to our engineering team and tying up a talented developer in doing manual data entry into a spreadsheet about what he or she has built over the last 7 years, we intercept that. We say, oh, we've seen this movie before, right? So those do take time. So we have our own that we filled out, and we try to preempt those by sending them to customers. But nevertheless, a lot of customers are going to want to use their own. They've got their own template, their own specific questions that they've decided are most important to them and their use case. And so it's us being ready to answer those questions, and hopefully quickly, and then beyond those calls when they have clarifying questions, right? Oh, so you said data's encrypted over this channel. Exactly what protocol are you using to encrypt it? And instead of just saying, that's a great question, let me go find an answer for you, it's like, oh, yeah, it's TLS 1.2. Or yeah, when that data is at rest, it's AES 256. And then, oh, okay, cool. And it checks the box on their side, and we can advance the conversation. But each of those is a potential hurdle that you could trip up on. And again, it just takes more time to get to the end zone on the deal.
Because not every customer that you're going to have is going to ask you these. And so sometimes they're coming at you with questions out of left field that you haven't seen before. How do you try and get in front of those and anticipate what's coming down the pipe?
Some customers, it's fair to say, we know they're going to ask. And so we try just to send them the kitchen sink even before they ask. I mean, even on that first call, it's a, hey, so we noticed you're in a regulated industry, your healthcare, finance, et cetera. We're going to go ahead and send you our entire package. This is our infrastructure. This is answers to some common security questions. Here's our privacy policy, our disaster recovery plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all zipped up in a neat file, and we're going to send it to you. And you can review it. And if you have any questions, which your SecOps team will have questions, because that's what they're paid to have, then we'll all join a call and we're going to answer them. And this will just expedite the whole thing. But rather than having the first demo and the decision maker gets all excited and is like, this is great, I'm going to go talk with the team and we'll see if we can get a pilot group ready. I tell you right now, there's no way that pilot's going to happen until SecOps has taken a look at it. So we sort of know this. So it's our role in some respects to help to project manage the sales process, because sometimes the prospect doesn't know that they're going to security review the application, but we know they're going to.
Yeah.
Because we've served someone in healthcare already. We serve someone in finance already. It's guaranteed. Some others, if it's like, okay, this is a, you know, this is an SMB, they're similar to us, we're not going through huge vetting processes while they're vendors, we're a small company. Then it's like, cool, we'll send them the information that just they need just in time, because that's how they do business. But these other larger companies have teams, they're going to project manage it eventually. So we can start by just taking the lead, and they appreciate that. It's like, oh, good, someone that knows the process, the dance that we're about to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it goes a long way in being upfront and getting ahead of, hey, we know you're going to need this, so we've prepackaged all of this information for you, versus being that more reactive in the sales process, saying, hey, oh, I'm not sure we can, you know, it just shows a lot of confidence that you're more likely to have put a lot of thought into, you know, these answers. I think I imagine it would inspire confidence in their SecOps team that you really have things buttoned up.
That's the goal. I mean, I think the first, you know, mini red flag that oftentimes the SecOps team will have is if they ask for a document or a plan and the answer is, oh, it's a great question, I don't know if we have that. And it's like, oh, we don't really want to read the plan that you're writing up in the background in a Google Doc, right? Like on the call. And that's probably that's not going to come in. So it's just saying, we've done this, don't worry. You're in good hands. And the same thing, and this gets a little tricky, but it goes into legal also. So I get involved in just the legalese, right? The redlining of the contract. And that comes back to supporting the team so that when the customer does do a redline, or if they're huge and they insist on using their own paperwork, right? They're going to use their software as a service agreement, which is invariably going to be, you know, 10 to 50 times longer than ours and take some reading. Then it's my role to try to turn that around quickly, which is kind of fun, actually, because then it's like, cool, I went to law school for a reason. I can apply some of that and read these contracts and hopefully do a good job reviewing them. But on the ones that the customer is redlining, I mean, it's not belaboring some of the stuff, right? I mean, if their counsel goes in and this is actually true in a lot of cases, a lot of the markup will be like, the reviewer on the customer side preferred a different font. They wanted to renumber the paragraphs. And it's like, go ahead. That's okay. Yeah. I don't need to object to that and say, actually, that's page 4. It's like, this is not important.
Who cares? So, you want to put a comma there?
Exactly. Yeah. Small things they want to highlight. They want to put something in all caps. They want to, you know, specify that, you know, venue will be in their place of business instead. It's like, these are small concessions that are pretty easy for a company like us to make. And then there's a few sticking points that we really look for that are like, yeah, that's not something that works out well, you know, in the long term. You know, if a customer's coming in and saying, you know, an example that I'll share that probably a lot of the audience has seen if they look at contracts is what's commonly referred to as a termination for convenience clause. I usually call that it's a contract, but it's not really a contract, right? So you've gone through all this trouble to create a document that defines roles, responsibilities, and pay terms, et cetera. And then there's a little line hidden in there somewhere that says, if we ever want to walk away, we'll just walk. And that in my opinion is not fair. That's like the technology vendor saying, hey, if we ever just want to turn it off, then we can, and there's no recourse.
And like, you still have to pay me.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's one where I think it's fair to say, yeah, no, that's not okay to have in the deal. We can make assurances. We can have service level agreements. We can have response time agreements, et cetera, to make people feel comfortable, but there's not a, hey, after all this work and after all these agreements and after all this customization and pilot and user acceptance testing, et cetera, that we can just kind of part ways anytime we want. That's not a start to a good, productive, long-term relationship. And we sort of learned that years ago where it was like, okay, but they're super into the app, so we'll just leave that in there. But it was always an indication of they're not ready yet, you know, to seal the deal. It's like, if they're including that, then someone's got cold feet, or they simply include it because it's pro forma for them. They always include it just to see if they can. And we're saying, mm-hmm. No, yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. I'm curious on the levels, just at what level do you start to see people wanting to use to redline their own paperwork or your paperwork, and versus, I see it as three levels. There's, let's see your TOS and your privacy policy and all that. Okay. Yeah. You know, we're good with that. We just want to read it, make sure you have it. Then there's, okay, we want to redline it and mark it up. And then there's, we want you to use ours. What are the three levels in terms of, ACV or MRR, like dollar value, you know? When's it worth it? When's it not worth it?
Yeah, for us, certainly the majority are straight through the TOS privacy policy, right? Web-based, we can review it, we see it, we're comfortable with it, let's go. Mm-hmm. Then there's the, you know, contracted, typically digital signature, you know, through a PDF on a DocuSign sort of platform. Everybody agrees, they can hold a copy of it in their electronic vault. They can print it if they want to. That's the document that's going to govern it. And that's almost always our document because it's like, it explains what we do and it's comprehensive and it provides a lot of protections for the customer. That's how we've written it. Then there's a few, and it's those top tier customers, right? So it's just a matter of, its size and influence. It's a power game. It's basically them saying like, actually, we're so big, we do so many of these contracts and we have such a big legal team and we want to mitigate our risk because it's so important because we're in a regulated industry or publicly traded, et cetera, that it's important to us that we use our own paper. And that's fine. Except for the fact that frequently it's kind of the wrong type of paper. That's improving now over the last year or so, but previously it was like we really want to use our paper and then they're sending a contract that's not for software as a service, and so then, you know, the first 20 pages would be all about how all code written is the property of the customer, et cetera, and it's like, no, that's not how this whole thing works. This is multi-tenant architecture. This is like Google, like Microsoft, like Salesforce. You don't get all right and title to any changes that happen over the next 3-year period of contract. So some of those required some clarification, right? Like, yes, we agree to pages 1-25 and 26-75, we're going to have to strike just because they're irrelevant.
Yeah. Thanks for making me read all that.
Exactly. Right. Like, it was an enjoyable bedtime read, but we need to get that out because that's not the type of software that we make.
Pages 26-75.
Yeah. Thankfully, you know, that's the minority of customers. Mm-hmm. people are pretty used to like, okay, if you've got clean paper and it protects us and it's good, we'll use ours.
Yeah. It's funny. The last time that happened to us was with, we did a deal with Uber, and they actually, they came back with paperwork that was much lighter weight than our paperwork. And I was very surprised because I was expecting fairly large, fairly fast moving company to have a massive legal team. No, they came back with a very simple, like, if it was 10 pages, it was barely 10 pages. I want to say it was.
And what a great thing, right? And I'd give them substantial credit, and I'm glad you brought up, because we've seen some of the larger companies do that. And it's kind of one of the old, I think we can attribute it to Ben Franklin, right? One of those those quotes where it's, if I would have had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. Mm-hmm. And it's that sort of thing. Like they've slimmed it down and made it simple so everyone can understand it. And we all benefit from that. Like it's better for us as a vendor, it's better for them. If there was ever a dispute, it'd be easy to find out what are the roles, responsibilities, rather than have it go into like, well, you can see in subpart 84 on page 56, like, oh no, that sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's good. I hope that continues. The legal industry is not famous for that. So if we're trending in that direction, and hopefully we can be part of it, then that's a great thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was one of those nice surprises. So I thought I'd give their legal team a shout out because they were an amazing company to work for, work with. Which, right. Not that it surprised me that they'd be a great company, but just anytime you see a company of a substantial size, you're like, okay, you're sort of gearing up for it. You're like, yep, psyching myself up. I know I'm going to have to like read this huge doc. And this tiny little PDF came from like, just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're getting
interrupt. Not what I was expecting.
Start up the electronic forklift for the Dell paperwork that's about to come over in your inbox. And it's like, oh, this is actually, I can handle this in an afternoon. No big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. And
so we've talked a little bit about compliance and how you're trying to get your ducks in a row and your docs sort of organized ahead of time. And same with the security side, you've got everything sort of prepackaged. But let's jump into the procurement process. I imagine there's some pitfalls, you know, beyond just having the right documentation available ahead of time. Talk to me about what are some of the things that you do to support the team there?
Yeah, in procurement, and look, I love the folks that work in procurement, but I have been known to historically call them the anti-sales. And the reason is because in a few early deals years ago, procurement would get involved, right? So larger organizations and say, hey, so somebody or our company wants to use the thing that you make. And that, you know, I'm going to need you to bring your price down, whatever it was, you know, some huge percentage. And it's sort of like, well, no, I mean, we've already kind of talked through that with the decision maker. And there's, you know, let's back up. Let me explain to you the value that we're providing. And so I'd go into the value, and one of the procurement specialists interrupted me and said, you know, hey, that actually sounds kind of interesting, but you have to realize that I came onto this call not knowing anything about what you do. And that's how I expect to end the, like, I don't need to know. My job is simply to get a lower price. That's how I'm paid. So that's why, you know, sales team's job is to get the highest price for the longest term, et cetera. And procurement's job is the opposite. Mitigate risk, make the price as low as possible. So I think it's helpful in those situations, because these are going to be larger companies, they're bringing more people to the table. You got your business decision maker, you got your SecOps, you got your legal, you have your procurement, you've got your signer somewhere up the chain that's going to actually, you know, put ink to paper digitally and say, yes, this is go. Meanwhile, as a small company, we've got our salesperson. Maybe our director of sales has joined in for a little bit of it. So I can help by being an extra warm body at the very least of like, cool, you're bringing seven people to call. We're at least bringing three. And so someone else to hear what's going on, but also some experience in navigating that. Just since I'm early in the company, I've done it longer. And so it's saying, oh, I've heard this before. This is how the deal worked out last time when we heard procurement go down this path. Or I'm hearing them, but I was on the call with you with the decision maker, and I think we're actually in a very strong position to maintain the great pricing that we've already shared. I don't think we need to move down anymore. So it's being that extra voice at the table with the salesperson to help navigate what is otherwise, I mean, a pretty heady conversation about, because procurement will say stuff like, well, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I guess I'll loop back with the team and we'll get back to you someday. And it's like, we mean someday. They said that the deal's ours. We won. You know, we beat out the competitors. We're your favorite. You've got users on it. We extended their trials. I thought we had a relationship. And then you got someone that's like, oh, I don't know what your stuff does. I don't know what relationship you think you have. So you got to be willing to kind of weather that storm, if you will, and also figure out where exactly you want to end up. You know, where's the conversation going to go? Where can you make concessions? Where are you going to hold firm? And how can you negotiate it out so that it's a great deal for the customer, but also maintains our margins so that we can provide them with the service they're bargaining for? So, yeah, it's fun. It's a dance. It's heady. Makes you kind of nervous. But that I think is part of the role of the director of sales and still part of my role, just because I have relationships with a lot of customers that have negotiated through procurement. So hopefully, if nothing else, just that experience gives you a little bit of confidence to sit in those meetings and say, okay, we will figure this out. It's going to take some time and some emotional energy and some math and moving the spreadsheet around, but we'll get there eventually.
So, you know, I got a couple more questions and then we'll wrap it up here, but can you offer some advice to if we have some frontline salespeople or even directors of sales that are, you know, listening in, watching in, what's some advice to them? You know, if maybe they don't have the support of, you know, people above them, how can they go about getting that? And how can they make the case to their team?
I think typically in most, I hope all, but certainly in most organizations, if the salesperson goes and says, you know, hey, sales leadership or executive leadership of the company, here's where we are. Here's where I've done. Here's the short narrative of the deal. So sort of beyond the analytics, beyond the, I'm in stage 4 of the opportunity pipeline. Like, okay, cool. Give me some color, right? Here's where we've been. Here's where I think we are. Here's where I'm trying to get to. I'm talking with procurement. This is getting a little fuzzy. It's interesting. They're trying to hammer me on the price. I want to maintain price. I want the company to have a great margin on this deal. I want to make a solid commission. You guys come in and provide some backup for me, or can you just come on the call? And I, you know, one of us is going to play a little bit harder line. The other can make a couple, you know, easy concessions for us to make, and let's see how it plays out. You know, that's something where I think any leader is going to be like, that sounds great. You know, I can come in and play a little bit of a hero role, like I was on the call where the deal got closed, even though certainly a salesperson has done all the work. But it also allows them to add some value as far as if the deal could potentially go sideways, hopefully they can right track it again and keep it going straight. You know, one thing that I will say, because it's come up, and it's been a couple of years, but it's come up a few times, the customer has said, you know, send your best price. And I responded, this is our best price. And then they would come back later and say, okay, we got your proposal. We just need you to come down a little bit more and the deal's yours. I didn't like that, because it made me feel like they were pushing me toward a place where I had not told the truth. They asked for best price. I gave best price. The best doesn't get best-er. It is. And so, right, like trying to make me a liar almost. Like, you asked for the best. I gave you the best. The best doesn't change. You know, give me your best effort. Okay, now go higher. It's like, no, it's supposed to be the best that you have. And so I responded, well, you asked me for my best before. That was the best. The best doesn't change. So the risk there was that, oh, so you're not willing to play ball anymore. You know, we're out. But in both of the cases where that came up, that was, in my opinion, the right thing to do. Those deals did get done. And it is important to draw the line somewhere, because, of course, everybody in sales knows it's really an N-1 problem. You know, well, it's going to cost $10. Well, we might be able to get the deal done. How about 9? Well, all right, we could do 9. Yeah, great. How about 8? You know, pretty soon it's like,
now you've gone through paperwork. You're emotionally invested, like, and you end up at 550, and you're like,
yeah. Now you're just like, I just want to get the deal done, and that's like all you're focused on is getting the deal done. And yeah, you're chipping away at your own margin, and as a salesperson, your own commission. So, you know, you got to kind of know where is your foundation on the deal. Where is the point where you go, look, that they must not be serious, or they're just probing, in which case you gotta say, hey, firm line on this. This is the best we can do. We said it was the best. Ball's in your court now. You gotta make a decision on it. So that's been important. I think, and this is almost a funny one, or perhaps an obvious one to say, but in an age of conference calls and Zoom calls and other relatively synchronous, but sometimes asynchronous communication, it's useful overall to stay on the line. That sounds kind of silly. It's kind of hacky. But over time, we've had some situations where there's a conference bridge and it's open and you will pick up some details on a deal. So you've finished your demo and it's like, great, we'll wrap up. We'll leave it open for any questions. And the other party might say, well, I think we're about done here. And the assumption is they've turned off the whole call or whatever. And they'll say something that's interesting. Well, hey, that was really good. I think it's better than the competition, but we'll see how they are on pricing. You know, we'll need them to be at X. Okay. So, you know, when it comes to the next call, procurement, kind of know where you stand. You know, you need to be pretty much at X or right around it to get that deal. So they essentially provided some guidance. Now, best case scenario, they've just done it straight at you. You know, hey, Brandon, here's the guidance for you. You're going to talk to procurement next. This is where you're going to need to end up. You know, wish we could do more. That's the way it is. Mm-hmm. That's our magic number. That's what can get approved without going to executive management or whatever the case may be. So I came to years ago, start asking, hey, in this deal, is there a magic number? Because many organizations have one. We can do a deal on the credit card for under $5,000. So if you price it $49.99, I can get this done and I don't have to go above and get signatures on this. Okay. So then it gives us something to think about. Do we want to do this fast for that price? Is that the right price? Or do it, it's like, oh, well, that's nice, but this is a $7,500 deal. So you're going to need to go get that signature. Mm-hmm. But it's useful to know what the magic number is or magic numbers are if there's tiers with different cutoffs. And it's helpful just to keep your ears open. Just like in a meeting where you go meet in person and someone walking through the hall says, man, I love that product. I'm so glad we're going to buy it. And it's your product and they haven't bought yet. You're pretty sure they're going to buy at that point. And the same stuff happens over video calls and voice calls where people will share interesting pieces of intelligence. And you can hopefully use that to the advantage of the deal to help expedite it and get it done.
Right on. I love how involved in the sales process you have been, despite, you know, in all of the growth that you've experienced over the last couple of years. I think it's amazing that your team has such a great founder that's still going to bat for them. So
I hope they feel the same way. No, I'm hoping that I'm useful. And honestly, you know, for those of us that have started in organizations and been on the sales side, that's part of the fun of starting a company is the customer relationships and the adrenaline that comes with the deal. Cause it's exciting to see the growth and be part of like, oh, cool. The start of a new customer. This is going to be awesome. And it's exciting. So it's fun to be, it's fun to do. And I would encourage folks that are in companies that keep doing it. If you've done it in the past, try to stay in the game.
Cool. Brings me to my last question. I don't know if there are a couple of these episodes published yet, but when was the last time you made a cold call? Just to add some context here.
Yeah, good question. Probably the last time was not this week. It was either the beginning of last week or the week before.
Perfect. So it brings me to my favorite segment, new segment of this, which is called the surprise cold call. Nice. So you get an opportunity to pitch the company, but you gotta cold call me. We gotta do some role play.
Okay. Are you gonna give me a phone number or we're gonna pretend we're all nine?
I got my phone right here. It's 867-5309.
Nice. All right.
Ring, hey, what's ring. Going on? Yeah. Hey, this is Colin.
Hey Colin, it's Brandon Bruce from over at Sears Insight. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Brandon?
Hey, doing well. Hey, I know you guys use Salesforce over there, so I'm hoping that our application that lives inside Gmail can be helpful to you all. We can help pipe a lot of your data into Salesforce for you and save you a ton of time.
So you're a piping company?
Yeah, we're a piping company, basically. It's like electronic piping.
I'm not sure we need that.
Well, I'd love a chance to show it to you because it's hard to describe just over the phone, but when you see it, you'll see why we've saved organizations literally millions of hours. So a lot of companies use it. I know a lot of your friends use it through LinkedIn because I've connected with them. It'd be great to get you on a demo and kind of show you around and give you a tour. Take about 5 minutes.
I'm really busy. 5 minutes is really hard, you know, hard for me to carve out from my schedule. What is this? what kind of time are we talking about saving me here?
Hey, totally understood. Well, thankfully, we're doing a lot of events. We're going to come out to Vancouver before too long. So I'd love to give you a shout. We'll stop by the office. We'll bring donuts and we'll show you and your team.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Donuts always wins. Donuts always wins.
There you go. So you tell me, you're showing up to every customer with
No, in fairness, it's not. However, we do get out quite a bit. So we'll do probably 2 to 3 dozen events nationwide, a couple in Canada this year. And so it is helpful to have that in the back pocket because I don't know that I did a particularly good job on the call. Because it is a surprise, which is good,
We'll send it to the team, your team. We'll get them to get James to grade you on this.
He'll critique the heck out of it.
James, I want to hear from you.
He's like, did you just say it was a piping company? No, but it is nice to have in your back pocket this idea that, hey, we can make this happen. We could do this in person. And I know, and I had this happen yesterday in the afternoon, someone said, I'm going to be in Knoxville. That's not super normal. Just say, hey, we're just going to be swinging through Knoxville. We'd like to meet you or just, you know, pitch you on this thing. And so that by itself is like, well, yeah, I want to be hospitable. Mm-hmm. It's our hometown. So, have you by the office and yeah, we'll spend time with you. So that was a winning pitch by them. And they didn't, you know, they kind of one sentence, this was by email. It was like a one sentence description of what they did. And they made it relevant to things that we've supported in the past had to do with schools. And we've done a lot with Knox County schools. And so I was like, yeah, I'd love to hear more about what you're doing and swing by the office. And so it has been helpful to us to be consistently going to a lot of the big cities, a lot of the user groups and saying, yeah, actually you're in New York. And tell you what, it is hard to carve out time for a demo. We'll stop by the office. Or why don't you come to this session that we're leading? You can bring the whole team. Here's free tickets. We'll bring pizza. And you're invited to the happy hour, whatever it is, make it kind of a little more intriguing, a little more interesting, and a little more personal in a world that they're probably getting, you know, 100 to 200 emails and calls, you know, daily or weekly, depending on their industry, wanting their time.
In this case, you're offering them pizza, beer, donuts.
Whatever. Or, hey, you know what we'd like you to do is send you a book. It's not even a sales book. It's just a book that we found valuable in running our business. And we think you'd like to read, is that okay to send you a book? And it's like, who doesn't want to receive it? You know, who's going to say no to it? There's a few people that'd be like, no, thanks. But most people is like, sure. I'll take a book from almost anybody. So that's people that have sent me or our company books. That's a winner. Cause I'll read it and I'll usually write back to say thanks because that's how we were raised, right? You receive a gift, you write a thank you note. So it's just reciprocal and it's good business.
Right on. I know I said the last question was the last question. This is the actual last question.
This is the second cold call. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. This is the hand on the doorknob trick. I swear I'm leaving now. What was the last book that somebody sent you that you actually read and sent them a thank you back?
Oh man, I'm trying to remember the title of it, but it was an HR company and they sent me a book about, you know, kind of like scaling up and managing that growth. And I was like, that was useful.
Is it called Scaling Up?
No, I have that book and that is a good book. I actually saw the author of Scaling Up speak last night in Nashville. Very cool event, but Vern came and spoke at the EO Nashville 30th anniversary. So it was really cool to see him live. But anyway, I'll at least share one of the books that I've been giving out to friends and family, anybody else that will listen is a neat book. It has nothing to do with software or with software as a service or business, but it's called Tattoos on the Heart. And it's written by a fellow named Greg Boyle. He's a Jesuit priest and runs a big program called Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles. So it's the biggest gang intervention rehabilitation program in the world. And so it was really neat to read. It's a book of stories, right, of his interactions with folks in, you know, the heart of Los Angeles and helping to really build that community up. And it is tangentially about business because it really revolves around the meaning that all of us can find in work. You know, he's helping to connect people with job opportunities and then with careers, and it's transformative. So it's cool. I mean, they're running now multi-million dollar businesses that employ hundreds of people doing silk screening and bakery and restaurant, all sorts of cool stuff. So anyway, that's my pitch for a great book that has over the last, I read it maybe a year ago, has meant a lot to me. So I think it's interesting if people read it, and I love to talk with people about it.
It's fantastic. So Tattoos on the Heart. What was the author again?
Author is Greg Boyle, Father Boyle.
Right on. Brandon, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Colin. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brandon.